This hour on IPR News, we talk to Northern Michigan's former Congressman Bart Stupak. The Upper Peninsula Democrat has a new book out about his role in passing Obamacare 7 years ago. Until the last minute, Stupak opposed the legislation. He fought with Democratic leaders because he worried tax dollars would fund abortions.
Why can't we just resolve this language and have no public funding for abortion in this legislation?
Then at the 11th hour, Stupak cut a deal with President Obama and helped guarantee the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
I'm pleased to announce that we have an agreement. And so with the help of the President, the Speaker, we were able to come with an agreement to protect the sanctity of life and the health care reform.
We'll talk about the controversy surrounding his vote and about the future of health care in this country. Plus, we'll take your calls. All that's ahead on IPR News Radio, but first, the news. This is special programming on IPR News Radio. Good afternoon. I'm David Castleman. Former Congressman Bart Stupak helped deliver key votes to pass the Affordable Care Act in 2010. The Upper Peninsula native did not support the legislation until the last minute when he got a guarantee from the president that public money would not fund abortions under the law. Stupak's decision led to a tsunami of threatening emails, phone calls, and letters from opponents of the law. But his efforts to keep public money from paying for abortions also made him rivals among Democrats. The Upper Peninsula native has since retired from Congress. Now Stupak has written a book about his experience called For All Americans, The Dramatic Story Behind the Stupak Amendment and the Historic Passage of Obamacare. He joins us from Washington this afternoon to talk. Bart Stupak, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
We're talking about your book. It's called For All Americans, The Dramatic Story Behind the Stupak Amendment and the Historic Passage of Obamacare. And this is a book, of course, about your role in passing Obamacare in 2010 and about the controversy surrounding it. In the book, you frequently write that, you know, you were living in your own healthcare hell, as you put it, at this time. If that's how you felt, I'm wondering what made you sit down and revisit those days and write a book about it.
Sure. What made me revisit those days and write the book was, in 2015, Harvard came to me, and after I left Congress, you know, I went up and did a fellowship up at Harvard. I talked about my role as chairman of Oversight Investigations and passing health care. And Harvard was intrigued with the personal struggle and professional struggle of my own personal beliefs and values, along with value and it found in the legislation, especially on providing abortion coverage with taxpayers' money in the health care bill. And that was a personal struggle. How do you overcome that? I wanted all Americans to have access to health care, but at the same time, I didn't want federal funding to be used for abortion. So that was a personal struggle. So Harvard came to me in 2015 and said, look, we used to do ethics and values in government based on the death penalty. That's sort of a worn out topic or theme. We'd like to do ethics and values in government based upon your role in passing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. So we worked on a case summary. And after about 30 pages, we got this case summary done and all the documentation to verify everything that's in the summary. And Harvard's been using that now for the last couple of years, well, since 2015, as a required study in 4 undergraduate courses. And I understand 1 graduate course, master level course, on ethics and values in politics. They use Bart Stupak as a case study. And at the same time, the BBC came to me, and they were doing a 4-part series on President Obama called The Obama Years, and part 2 was on health care. And as they went around Washington, D.C. doing their interviews about the Obama administration, everyone kept telling them they should talk to me. So BBC came over, talked to me once, twice, 3 times, and then went back to London. And when they came back to London, they sent me a package along with a note basically saying, you must tell your story about health care really came to fruition, because without your efforts, it never would have passed, and you tell quite a remarkable story. And again, that was in the spring of 2015, Harvard and BBC at the same time. So that's when I thought, all right, I'm going to actually sit down and write this. And then as sort of a little teaser, BBC sent me a clip of Rahm Emanuel. Rahm, at the time, was President Obama's chief of staff. And on the clip, Rahm has taken credit of sitting down with me, and one afternoon, according to Rahm, we negotiated the executive order, which allowed for the passage of the Affordable Care Act. That was not true. Rahm was never in the room. Rahm was never involved in the discussions Or negotiations about the executive order.
As I understand it, though, you did have a few phone calls, or at least he left you a few voicemails, though, with a few choice words.
Those weren't even on the executive order. He did. Rahm talks that way. I mean, every other word, you'd have to bleep it out if we're on the radio here. That's just Rahm's style. I mean, every other word is F this and F that. And again, one of my staffers, without our knowledge, went out and put out an email which sort of torpedoed the Senate health care bill without my knowledge. Actually, it was over the Christmas holiday, and none of us knew about it until we got this call from Rahm and a couple other people at the White House. And Phil Schillero, who was just the opposite of Rahm, who would never say a bad word or swear ever. Even he was upset, and we knew nothing about it. Both my chief of staff, Scott Schlegel, and I, we knew nothing about it, and we finally tracked down this staffer and put out an email under my name. So there was a lot going on in this whole thing. It's, you know, in the book, they say it's really a fascinating story about the inner workings and the behind-the-scenes dealing and all that went on. Even my own staff, at least one of them, was trying to subvert all the efforts I was trying to do to pass not only health care but also to protect the sanctity of life and make sure that there's not public funding for abortions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit. The Democrats won back the House in 2006, and then President Correct. Obama was elected in 2008. Correct. And all of a sudden, Democrats were in total control. Then the health care debates began in 2009. At what point during those debates did you realize that the issue of abortion and this bill was a problem for you?
Well, from the very beginning, the first briefing we had in April of 2009 on the health care bill, I was the skunk at the party, if you will, because I raised my hand. I said, well, whatever you do, make sure you don't include abortion in here, because that will destroy the bill in and of itself. There's a large group of us that feels that the current law, which was the Hyde Amendment, which basically says there's no public funding for abortion. No, we can't ban abortions in this country. Supreme Court says it's legal in the first trimester. The only thing we could do is prevent federal funding, as we had for the last 30-some years, to make sure taxpayer funds, public funds, were not used to pay for abortions. And I pleaded with them not to put that in the health care bill. But the leadership, and maybe it was because they had a majority, they just ignored us. And sure enough, they put it in the bill that there would be public funding for abortion. And we repeatedly pleaded with leadership not to make abortion the issue in healthcare. Let's talk about the values of the healthcare. Let's talk about the 45,000 Americans who die every year because they don't have access to quality, affordable healthcare. But they were just blind and stubborn in their views and kept interjecting abortion, and we kept objecting, and that's how it all started. And it was a heartburn all the way through. And then after we passed the STUPAC amendment in November.
Let's talk about the STUPAC amendment.
Sure.
Spell out what the STUPAC amendment was.
STUPAC amendment is nothing more than the Hyde Amendment, which says the federal government cannot have a policy which promotes or encourages abortion, nor can the federal government use their money to pay for abortions. It's basically the Hyde Amendment. How did it come to become called the STUPAC amendment? The press dubbed it the STUPAC amendment because when I was on the Committee of Jurisdiction, Energy, and Commerce Committee. As we were debating the health care bill, Joe Pitts actually offered the amendment. But since he's in the minority and I was the Democrat, senior right-to-life Democrat on the committee, I offered the amendment. After that, sort of got dubbed the STUPAC amendment. And then we went to the Rules Committee in November. I was the lead sponsor on it, so it was called the STUPAC amendment. And STUPAC amendment is nothing more than Hyde. Again, we didn't change anything. All we said was keep the status quo as it had been for the last 30-some years, no public funding for abortion. And we just continue to get pushback from the pro-choice community and the pro-choice women in the Congress. Even though I even struck a deal with Nancy Pelosi so we would not have abortion as being the main issue in health care, that issue was rejected by the women and congressional women. And then we had to have the STUPAC amendment the next day, and fortunately, many Democrats, including pro-choice Democrats, voted for the STUPAC amendment because the issue was not choice or life. The issue was, do we use public funding to pay for abortion? And many of the pro-choice members of Congress, Democrat members of Congress, have always voted in the past, I'm pro-choice, but they'll say, but no, we do not use public funding for abortion.
Well,
so they were surprised how big of a 64 Democrats voted with me, and it's a huge majority. And a lot of them were conservative pro-choice Democrats. But when you frame the issue that way, many members had a long history of not voting for public funding for abortion.
We'll come back to the Stupak Amendment in a couple minutes. I should remind you that you're listening to a live call-in program with former Northern Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak on IPR News Radio. You can call in with your question or comment at 800-681-5929. Let's go back in time a little bit.
Sure.
You were elected to Congress for the first time in 1992.
Correct.
What were your views on health care back then when you arrived in Congress?
I was all for health care. When I was elected in 1992, I promised three things to the voters. Number one, raise a minimum wage. Number two, we would get our fiscal house in order. And number three, we'd pass health care for all Americans. And in 92, health care was a big issue. And my first campaign brochure says, I always believe that health care is a right. It's not a privilege for those who can afford it. And in my own personal experience, you know, I was injured in state police. All my surgeries and that were paid for. I had a son who was in and out of the hospital quite a bit and was labeled a chronically ill child. That was all paid for because I had good insurance. I had good health care. But, you know, then I had was in the state police, got injured. Everything was paid for because it was on-the-job injury. And I watched other individuals who did not have health insurance and who did not have money to pay for prescription drugs actually struggle or forego treatment because they couldn't afford it. And I just thought it was wrong. And my time in the state legislature, we tried to pass a bill on balanced billing. In other words, if you're on Medicare at the time or Medicaid, they'll pay 80% of your doctor bill, and then that 20% that's left, if you don't have a supplemental policy, it comes out of your pocket. It's called out-of-pocket expenses. So if you're on a publicly financed program like Medicare or Medicaid, you shouldn't be balanced billing. Back in the 1980s, it was usually, you know, $2, $4, $6, $10 or something like that. And we just thought it shouldn't be balanced billing. But again, we lost that amendment, and that never became law. So there were a number of issues that along my life that influenced my strong feelings on health care. And I always thought it was wrong. The last country in the world, major country, industrialized nation, it cannot find a way to provide health care for their people. So it was always a strong passion. And if you know me, I no matter what the issues, I'm not a bomb thrower. I'm not a real, you know, I don't wear the issues on my sleeve. I just quietly work to get the job accomplished. And that's what I did on whether it was raising a minimum wage, trying to get a balanced budget, or health care. We just quietly did our job.
You can join the conversation by calling us right now. The number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. I want to talk about a very sad part of your life that you write about openly in this book, your son BJ's suicide in 2000.
Yep.
What influence did that have on you as a lawmaker in your work in Washington?
Well, if anything, BJ's death reestablished a great commitment I have to life. All life is precious at all stages. And when it's violently ripped from you unsuspectingly on a Sunday morning, that life becomes even more greater. And I think you have a greater sensitivity to all aspects of life. And you realize how precious and sacred life is. And therefore, you do what you can to try to protect and make sure all Americans have access to quality, affordable health care, including mental health services, which is the first time that's ever happened in our country. Mental health services underneath the Affordable Care Act is actually a essential benefit under the Affordable Care Act. We tried for 18 years while I was in Congress to try to make mental health parity with other illnesses and diseases and be covered by insurances. We never could do that. However, it is part of the Affordable Care Act. It is part of Obamacare. And you see it being of great use with the opioid addiction we got going on in this country. The governors tell us they're using that essential benefit, the mental health essential benefit, to set up inpatient and also outpatient treatment for opioid addiction. And it's of great value to their states, and they've pleaded with the Republican majority not to repeal Obamacare, especially this mental health aspect of it, because we're trying to break people of their drug habits. Unfortunately, my son BJ did have an adverse reaction to a drug based on a number of things. It was sort of like a perfect storm. We did not know it at the time, but after BJ died, and a few years later, I was looking at the autopsy. We realized he only had one kidney, which we never knew. And so, therefore, he could not process, his body could not process a drug, and thus he had an adverse reaction, which led to his depression and a spontaneous suicide one day.
And that was the acne drug Accutane that
correct.
He was taking, correct?
Correct.
And you had a chance to investigate Accutane.
Yeah, we did. With the help of my friends on the Energy and Commerce Committee, we did take a closer look at this drug. It was rushed to market in less than 9 months. It was back in the 80s, and there never was real studies done on it. About the time the month BJ died in May of 2009, and that month the FDA actually put out a warning that this drug would cause spontaneous suicides, and they based it upon a study they did. Young people like my son, average age was 17, males, no intervening factors, but suddenly they took their life with a firearm, as BJ did. And after doing those investigations and not finding intervening causes for young people to dramatically or spontaneously take their lives, they issued the warning, but for us it was too late. We already got it. BJ was already dead. So we've now, through the efforts of Congress and others, there are black box warnings on the drug, and people are advised of the serious consequences of this drug. But again, even if you had all those serious consequences and looked at BJ, you'd say, well, none of them applied to him. Again, we didn't know until probably a couple years later that he only had one kidney, and the problem there was the doctor never established the baseline. When you get on this drug, you're supposed to establish your baseline. How do the drug react in your blood system, triglycerides, your statins, and your cholesterol? They never established that for BJ, and BJ struggled on the drug. We did not realize it then. Probably struggling because he only had one kidney. His body couldn't process it.
You're listening to a live hour with Congressman Bart Stupak, who served 18 years in the U.S. House representing Northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula. You can join in the conversation. We'd love to take your call. 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. You're an anti-abortion Democrat, and you served in Congress, especially early in your terms, you know, at a time when that wasn't an uncommon thing. I'm wondering, were there any moments as a congressman, any other moments where you felt yourself pulled in two directions over abortion, similar to the way that you were during the healthcare negotiations?
Well, yeah, after I got there, 1992, once again, Democrats were in charge of the presidency, the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And during that time, we actually had a vote on whether the Hyde Amendment would apply in 93-94. And, of course, I voted for the Hyde Amendment, but we actually lost that vote. We actually lost that vote in which there were more pro-choice members of Congress who did not vote for the Hyde Amendment, and therefore it passed. The point I'm trying to make there, even though I disagreed with the president's legislation, which allowed federal funding for abortion, at least we had a chance to vote on the floor and vote our conscience and vote our district and what our districts wanted us to do. So after that, 93-94, I was very disappointed because that had been the law of the land by then, probably about 20 years. And I was disappointed that it was overturned. And then in 95, when Republicans took back control of the House, we put the Hyde Amendment back in. So during that two-year period, yeah, it was a real difficult time for those of us who were right to life and believe that we should not have public funding for abortion. But in what happened in 2009 and in 2010, why this became a big issue again, Democrats were in control of all phases of government, the presidency, the House, and Senate. And all the leadership was pro-choice, so they wouldn't even let us offer our amendments. We weren't even allowed to. We'd go to Rules Committee and offer our amendment, and they'd just smile and say thank you, and we never heard about it again. So they denied us even an opportunity to vote on the floor of the House for these amendments, for a Hyde Amendment. They were just trying to completely shut us out of the process, and that's why the book gets so much in detail into parliamentary procedures we did and how a rule is so important, and you can defeat legislation by preventing the rule from coming to the floor. A rule just simply says okay, what is the name of the bill? How long will it be debated? What amendments are made in order? Because with 435 members of Congress, you have to have some rules so there's some not complete chaos on the floor. So, I mean, the difference, every member has to have a right to vote what they believe is in the best interest of their district and also what's in the best interest of the nation. You're seeing this with the tax bill right now, the tax bill they're trying to push through. You know, members are saying we need some votes on some of these proposals. You see Senator Lee and Senator
Rubio.
Senator Lee and who am I missing here?
Senator Rubio.
Rubio, yeah. I mean, when they voted on the bill in the Senate, the child tax deduction was increased to $2,000. Now in this latest version, it's only $1,100. They lost $900 in the process. So they're saying, we're not going to vote for it unless you give us an opportunity to improve this provision. And I understand that they've added another $300. So it went from $2,000 per child down to $1,400. It's better than what it was, but I'm not sure that's enough to win over those votes. I mean, you stake out certain positions for Senator Rubio and Lee. It's like, okay, child tax credit's $2,000. Okay, we can do that. You doubled it. We'll go along with you. But then when the final bill comes back, it's only $1,100 as opposed to $2,000. At least they're standing up for a belief that they have and a principle that's important to them in their districts and their states. So that's what it should be. But you're seeing this tax bill being rammed through. The health care bill, fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, as I go through, as your first question was, health care hell for a whole year, because that bill went on for a year.
And go
ahead.
During that, you did get the House to vote on the Stupak amendment.
Yes.
And the House passes it.
Correct.
And then the Senate does not.
Right.
And this sets up a showdown over this issue for you and for a number of members in the House. What was going on at that point when you know the Senate had rejected it?
Well, we knew the Senate would be difficult because you have to have 60 votes in the Senate to pass anything, as you know, that majority,
right.
60% supermajority. And anyways, we knew it had an uphill battle, and even while we're working on in the House, I kept telling the Catholic bishops, don't worry about the House. I'll take care of the House. Get over to the Senate. That's where our problems are going to lie. And I don't think they took me seriously. And when it came to the Senate, we could only get 45 votes. We were 15 short. So there's no way that was going to pass. So now you had a difference between the House version and the Senate version, much like you do with the tax bill we're just talking about. And we thought there would be a conference committee. Well, funny thing happens on the way to elections. Scott Brown won the Kennedy seat up in Massachusetts, so therefore you only had 59 Democrats, and therefore they couldn't get 60 votes on the health care legislation. So much like the tax bill, they put it on a reconciliation package, which again led to no meaningful amendments to the legislation. So we had to come up with a different way to address it.
But they could pass it with 51 votes.
51 votes, correct. Correct. Mm-hmm. I think they passed it with like 56, 57. But what we had to do, though, the health care bill, everyone talks about it, there was really about four different bills there. There was one for Indian Health Services was included in there. There was on tuition waiver was in the bill. There were all kinds of other parts of this, and we could amend certain parts, knock out things, but then we couldn't add anything. So we had to find another way to address the Stupak Amendment or no public funding for abortion. You cannot legislate on an appropriation bill, so we had to find a different way of doing it. I tried a technical corrections bill, again, which is a legislative maneuver, which is explained in the book. But we did end up going with the executive order, which, and I'll give President Obama credit, after we passed it, there has not been public funding for abortion. The disappointment I do have with him was he allowed the Secretary of HHS to come up with this contraceptive proposal, which is a basic essential element in healthcare, which I agree with, but you should not have abortifacient drugs in there, and he allowed four of them in there. So, but as a general rule, there is no public funding for abortion still today. There are not grants or loans given from the HHS to perform healthcare that has abortion in it. Even a catastrophic fund that we established did not have abortion in it. and the community health centers, which we greatly expanded in the Affordable Care Act, you cannot perform abortions at the community health centers. So Obama kept his word, and the executive order still in existence today still provides for that safeguard of no public funding for abortion.
You're listening to a live call-in program with former Congressman Bart Stupak on IPR News. You can join in with your question or comment. The phone number is 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. At one point during this debate, your good friend and political ally Mike Doyle, who's a congressman from Pennsylvania, he votes for a rival provision to the Stupak Amendment. He's also an anti-abortion Democrat. I imagine that this put some stress on your friendship, or at least on your working relationship. I'm wondering, you know, how did this whole ordeal affect your relationships with your colleagues?
Friends like Mike and I, we don't let an issue as deeply held as we have divide us. Mike is generally right to life, but since his district has moved from the suburbs to the city of Pittsburgh, he has voted more and more along the lines of pro-choice, which I knew that. But I was surprised that he would second the CAPS amendment, which was the one that allowed for public funding of abortions in the Affordable Care Act on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Mike and I sat on the same committee. And I was just surprised he did that. That was a little hard. But Mike was a good friend. We lived together. We both had boarding rooms over at C Street. Even that night after that amendment, we walked back to the to our boarding rooms, if you will, and probably didn't say anything to him that night. I was a little miffed at him. Mm-hmm. But our friendship survives. It's not if you know the individual and you're doing legislation, you can't take everything personal. If it becomes personal, you lose your objectivity. So Mike and I are friends, remain friends. Mm-hmm. We moved out of C Street. We went and got apartment together over on A Street. Again, our own little rooms there over on A Street. In fact, I just saw him again yesterday. We're just talking about the holiday break that they're all on, and we just talked a little bit about some things. Mike's a friend, remains a friend.
Let's go to March 2010, when it's crunch time on this bill, and a vote is approaching. You describe the scene around your congressional office. You've become sort of a point person where a lot of people are calling and trying to talk to you and trying to influence your vote.
Right.
What was it like to be working in your congressional office at that point?
It was chaos. Christian groups, religious groups, wherever you want to do, they set up prayer vigils in front of my office, and we could not conduct work. The Capitol Police had to come by and had to keep clearing the hallway so people could walk down the hallway, and they would try to take over the little inner reception area of my office. We finally got them out of the office, and then they sat in front of the door, and then they kept opening up the mail slot and chanting prayers and that through the mail slot. And finally, we had to tape that shut. And finally, we just had to shut down the office because we couldn't get anything done. My staff could not go in and out of the office without being badgered. It just got a little carried away. And outside, of course, was the Tea Party. I wasn't even allowed to go outside. Towards that last weekend, I was pretty much under 24-hour police protection with all the death threats and everything going on. And if I would have to go somewhere, I was escorted by the Capitol Police. They would wait. I'd do my meeting. They'd escort me back to my office. And then the Saturday and Sunday, 19th, 20th, 21st of March, I wasn't asked me not to go outside because they couldn't control the crowds out there, the Tea Party. And I didn't want to cause any problems, so I didn't. Being former law enforcement, I understand what they were saying. It's not that I couldn't go outside, it's just that they could not guarantee my safety or the safety of others or the safety of the police officers who are trying to help us because of the size of the crowds. We just didn't have enough people to control it. Mm-hmm. So we took special precautions and did the backways and the byways of the buildings in the Capitol to move me around. And the Capitol Police did a great job. I went to my meetings, got my job done, and I'm safe and sound. And they, like I said, they did a good job.
You're listening to a live call-in program with retired Northern Michigan and UP Congressman Bart Stupak on IPR News Radio. You can join in, 800-681-5929. We'd love to have your call. That's 800-681-5929. So you mentioned the executive order that President Obama signed that guaranteed your vote and a number of your colleagues.
Correct.
How did that compromise come to be?
Well, we got to Friday. This is in March of 2010. It had to be about the 18th, 19th of March, 2010. The White House had tried to meet with a number of Right to Life Democrats who were still not committed to vote for the Affordable Care Act, and they met with them without me. And when they asked where I was, the legal counsel, White House legal counsel, would just say, "Well, we don't know. I didn't make the invite list." And so they tried to divide my group, and my group said, "No, we're not going to do the executive order. We're not going to agree to anything without Bart Stupak." I was chair of Right to Life Democrats. I was chair of the Congressional Bipartisan mm-hmm. Right to Life Caucus. So they said, "He's the guy who really knows this issue and all that. We're just not going to agree to anything without him." And that sort of fell apart. And I was still working on a technical correction bill. And then as it got to be late Friday evening, knowing we're going to vote sometime over the weekend on health care, Mike Doyle actually came to me and said, "If you had an executive order, what would you put in it?" And I rattled off the things I needed to have in an executive order. He says, "Why don't you write one?" I looked at him. I said, "No, I've never written an executive order. I'm not about to start one now." He said, "Well, just put down your ideas. We'll work it from there." So Mike was, in a way, even though he seconded the CAPS amendment, was sort of like the go-between between me mm-hmm. and the White House and really the leadership. And we started to work it out. And just about everything we wanted in the executive order we received in order to have us vote for it. And again, it was just a reiteration of current law, which is in the executive order. And the executive order has full force and effect of law. And what executive order really says is this is how an administration is going to implement a law passed by Congress. And then the other thing we did was actually do a colloquy on the floor between myself and Chairman Henry Waxman, where we talked about the executive order and the purpose was to prevent public funding for abortion. That's all on the congressional record. That's why the executive order has never been challenged legally, even though the Republicans and even some of the pro-choice women kept saying it's not worth the paper it's written on because you can't enforce it in court. The language they pointed to is the language that's in every executive order. An executive order does not by itself give you a cause of action to go sue the federal government or the president. And that's found in every executive order. Of the thousands of executive orders that have been issued by all presidents, there's only been two that have ever been ruled unconstitutional. But the colloquy on the floor was to state the express intent of the Congress that there not be public funding for abortion. That was an added security and added mm-hmm. condition I received from the president and the House leadership to make sure there'd be no public funding for abortion. So it wasn't just the executive order. It also gave us a colloquy which expressed the intent of the Congress that there'd be no public funding of abortion.
Let's go to the phones. We have Ellen in Traverse City on the line. Ellen, what's your question for yes. Congressman Stupak?
Actually, I have just a comment. I have his book, and I've been reading it. I'm almost at the end. It is an amazing viewpoint of what goes on, and I think people really have to read it to understand all of the work that you put in for any of this legislation. It is fascinating, really, really amazing. So I just wanted to thank you for writing the book. I was at your TC signing and have been putting hours in just reading it. So thank you and have a wonderful new year.
Well, thanks, Ellen. I'm glad you're enjoying the book.
You can join in, too, with your call, 800-681-5929. That's 800-681-5929. When you announced that you would vote for the bill and that you had a deal with the president, it set off a firestorm of criticism and support. You described what was going on before the vote. What was your life like, immediately after that vote?
Well, I actually stopped the book on the night we voted for health care. Because if my life was bad or difficult during working up to the executive order and passage of the Affordable Care Act, became even worse, more of a nightmare after the vote. Just all the death threats. There was a probably about two and a half week period where not just my wife and I, but also our son in California, we were all under 24-hour police protection. Just really difficult times for us, personally, professionally. And it was very, very difficult. I mean, I'm sure when people hear this interview, I'm sure I'll get some obscene phone calls at my home or nasty emails because people disagree with with my position and what I did. And I still believe in the Affordable Care Act and the quality of health care it's provided for all Americans. And so, I mean, when I talked earlier about Mike Doyle and personal, I guess throughout all my years, I've learned to rise above the personalities in order to pass or to achieve your goal, whatever it may be. And so, you know, this rancor you see now in public life and you know, the ripping down of each other, it was horrible back then. It continues. We have to rise above that if we're ever going to, you know, work on difficulties we have as a country and as a nation. You do it by working together, not by ripping each other down. And it's been a difficult time. It still is a difficult time. I mean, the anniversary of the Affordable Care Act comes up, and media announces it. My phone lights up, or my emails light up with hate mail. So I mean, it's still there. But you know, it's part of public service. You have to do what you believe is right. And I believed I believe in the principle that all Americans should have access to quality, affordable health care. They have a right to health care. Even if this current Congress, Republican-controlled Congress, repeals Obamacare, I have no problem with that as long as they replace it with something that all Americans have access with health care. But you haven't seen that. They've tried to repeal it so many times, 50, 60 times, and they have no backup plan. Again, any Congress can change what we did when we passed the Affordable Care Act. You can change that. All I ask is don't play politics with it. Give us a policy that replaces it. Give us sound policy. If it's as good or better than the Affordable Care Act, and the Affordable Care Act does need improvement, I'll be the first to endorse it. I'm more interested in the policy and not the politics.
Let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Jim in Traverse City. Jim, you're on the air. Jim, can you hear us?
Yeah, hi, Bart.
Yes.
Yeah. I've always been one of your big backers, and I was sorry to see you not run for re-election that year. And I've always thought that you would have been re-elected, that the Fuhrer would have died down. But I do know that your success over the years had a lot to do with the fact that you were a Democrat, which is generally doesn't get a majority in northern Michigan, but you were a right-to-life Democrat, which brought in a lot of Republicans. Is the reason that ultimately that you didn't run for re-election that you thought you probably would not get re-elected?
No. As I mentioned in the book, and the story's been told many times by a lot of my staff who knew, I had decided that term that was my last term. When Obama was elected that night, when he went down to Grant Park to give his speech, victory speech there over when he won over Senator John McCain, I told my wife that night that was it. I'd run my last race. I'm done. We're going to pass health care. No matter who would have won that year in 2008, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama for the Democrats, we would have passed health care. And I could see my last goal that I wanted to achieve in Congress was going to be completed. I didn't think I'd play the role that I did, but I knew we'd get it done, and I was done. I had served 18 years. The longest anyone else ever served in that district is 12 years. It is such a massive district. You just get tired out. You just can't keep up like this. And even in the book, I cite one time there where I had to go to Jack Gengrass' funeral over in Iron Mountain. It's about an hour and 15 minutes away from my home. I jumped in the car to go, and I just couldn't drive anymore. I just mentally and physically, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I had already made up my mind, and in a way, by having my mind made up, I wasn't worried about the politics. There were many articles written. I had national news media following me around because I continue to still do town hall meetings and conduct it myself as a representative should hold town hall meetings on health care and other issues. And they all wrote that, you know, while there was this fear over the Stupak Amendment, I was catching hell from both sides. They all said, but everyone that they had talked to said, no, we're still going to, we might disagree with the guy, but we like him. We're still going to vote for him. I wasn't worried about reelection. I just had it. I wanted to do something different in my life. I lasted longer than anybody else. I've run up the largest vote totals than anyone else. There's nothing more for me to accomplish. I really did want to step back and do something else with my life. So I'm proud of my 18 years. As President Obama, when he's trying to talk me into running for reelection, is would be better if you do 20. And I just told Mr. President, no, for me and my family, and we've made our decision, and I'm going to stick with it.
Thanks for your call, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
We have another call. Mark in Traverse City. Mark, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I had a question for the congressman, and I've been a Republican my entire life, but I voted for Bart, and I respect what he's done for our state and our region. And I hearken back to the fact I went to Saginaw Valley and then Cooley, so I have that in common with him. And one of the issues I was concerned about through the Affordable Care Act, I know that he took great efforts in the to eliminate abortion funding, is when I look at it, there's an extraordinary amount of contraceptives. Almost every form of it is completely covered. And in my family, we've had the to deal with infertility, and nearly every aspect of infertility is out of pocket. And it is someone that is pro-life as well. It kind of is a separate sect, but I was wondering if there's any insight on why that is, because I find it, you know, wholly unfair, I guess, that I'm spending, you know, tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket above and beyond insurance coverage. And, you know, people that want to have contraceptive procedures, you know, it's paid for by my tax dollars. So I'm just curious about that concept.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, Mark, you're right. It doesn't pay for infertility, and I'm not sure what plan you have. As you remember, underneath the Affordable Care Act, and again, it's been changed because the money's been starved. The Republican-controlled Congress has starved the Affordable Care Act by cutting its funding. But there used to be, everybody was sort of guaranteed a bronze, silver, or gold package, three different layers of plans you could get. It's always my understanding, if you had the gold package, which is the most expensive, that many of the drugs for fertility would be covered. But it depended on the plan. And in the past, I've not known Medicare or Medicaid to actually pay for fertility drugs. So I guess it just depends on the quality of the plan you have. You're right about contraceptive. There are 14 different methods they cover and paid for by the government, four of them which are abortifacia, which I disagreed with, and that's why I disagreed with the contraceptive plan put out by HHS, Secretary Sebelius. And actually, that was the issue in Little Sisters of the Poor, and I wrote a amicus brief in the U.S. Supreme Court supporting Little Sisters of the Poor because it's just a different form of abortion coverage. So,
Bart,
go ahead.
We've got a few minutes left. I want to ask, how do you think the ACA has worked overall since it passed?
Well, it's worked in that it's given access to all Americans to health care. Now, my big disappointment, again, is, you know, after it's passed, there are no perfect laws. We have to make changes on it. And instead of making changes, the Republican Party has starved it by not properly financing it, repealing some of the taxes. In fact, this tax bill they're working on there, some of the taxes that we use to pay for the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Remember, the Affordable Care Act did not add to deficit. We paid for it. It was paid for through taxes and other funding sources. Those have been choked off. So it makes it more expensive, and therefore the premiums go up, which only makes sense if the federal government isn't going to kick in their share to help people afford health care and falls back on the individual and private insurance companies. It's going to increase the cost. So the legacy of the Affordable Care Act, no matter what happens, is that now Americans expect that they have a right to health care. And hopefully 45,000 Americans won't be dying every year because they don't have access to basic health care. That's one every 12 minutes an American dies because they don't have access to health care. So, and like I said, no matter what happens, I think the legacy is now that Americans expect it, and they should be, this country should be able to provide quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Remember when we passed the Affordable Care Act, we're just coming out of that big global recession. We were in the global recession, 2009, 2010. And the rates, when I know people complain, they go up 15, 20, 30% now. Back then, they were going up 100%, 130%. I still had those emails from constituents saying, my health insurance just went up 100%. I got dropped. Small businesses were dropping health insurance. Everybody was because of just could no longer afford it.
Yeah, a number of Democrats led by Bernie Sanders, well, Bernie Sanders is an independent, but a number of Democrats are pushing for single-payer health care. What do you think the future of health care should be?
Sure, they're calling it Medicare for All, and that has a place. Yeah, sure, I could see us moving Medicare down to age 55 and then cover people, but at the same time, you still got to expand your Medicaid for the lower-income folks. And then people still should have a better option. Those who are not 55 or older and who are not on Medicaid, they have to have an option. I always thought that we should allow them to buy into the federal employees' health benefit package because we have federal employees all over the nation. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's right there. So, I think Americans now expect it. Even, now they just shortened the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act for next year. And in this tax bill, the individual mandate will be repealed. But yet, more people signed up this year in a shorter period of time because they shortened the windows and all the controversy we've had on the Affordable Care Act. More people signed up this year than ever, like 750,000 more than last year, and last year was the most. So when people actually take away Obamacare, take away Affordable Care Act, and say, here's an insurance policy we're offering you which allows you to recover pre-existing injuries, there's no catastrophic stunt, you won't have filed bankruptcy if you buy one of these policies because we capped the out-of-limit, out-of-pocket expenses. Your child can stay on till age 26. You put all these things out there, and people look at it and they say, that's a great policy. I'd love it. Then you say, it's Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. They said, oh, I don't want it. The program is a good program. It needs to be fixed. There are some things we have to do differently. But when people, if you take away the politics and look at it, it's a quality plan that they're willing to pay for and sign up for.
Well, Bart, unfortunately, our time's just about up. Bart Stupak, his new book is called For All Americans, The Dramatic Story Behind the Stupak Amendment and the Historic Passage of Obamacare. Bart Stupak, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, David.